Jimmy D and the Wolf.
Hello. Hello.
First one was muffled. Have to do it again.
False start.
Yes. Okay, here we are.
Yeah, man.
So I chose a tentative topic about how to get more energy. There's an article that I read in the New Yorker. It's very technical, but we don't have to do that. We can talk about other things.
Well, I like it. Getting more energy, being more productive, and really managing your time.
Okay. Well, what's your take on that? How do you do that?
I live every single day of my life by to-do lists. And then I prioritize things. Like, I have the big things that there's no way humanly possible you can get them done in one day. And every day I'll write my to-do list. Sometimes it's always at least 10 things. Some days it's 25 or 30 things. And then to the right, I will have like a subset of the big things that need to happen that aren't always completely in my control. There's usually four or five of them in business. They get checked off kind of as I go. If it's something, you know, like the thing we did this week, the indemnification thing, or if it's, you know, getting another truck or something like that. And so I get laughed at by people here because I will literally carry my notebook around like a little kid. I'll go into diners and eat lunch, and I'll have my notebook and check things out. But what I've learned, man, since I started doing that, like write it down, make it happen, two things that I've noticed. Most importantly, I'm 1,000 times more productive than I ever was before because I feel personally accountable for things when I write them down. If it's on that list and it didn't happen, it's my fault, 100%, and I can't have that. But the biggest thing that I've taken away, and I don't remember where I read this, I think maybe Robert Kiyosaki said it, to win tomorrow, you have to win tonight. And so when I started honing in this whole to-do list thing, when it started getting really, really productive, is when I would do it before I would go to bed at night. When your mind's kind of clear right before you go to sleep, it's not all jumbled up. I would say, I need to do this, 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 and this, all these things tomorrow. And then you kind of visualize getting them done. Well, then I wake up in the morning, it's like, I know exactly what's on that list. And you have this different sense of like urgency, you know, try to get it done because the reward to me is, some days it's getting more streamlined, and now I'm having days every once in a while where that list is done by noon. And when that list is done by noon, it's like, great, I can do whatever I want to do for the rest of the day. You know, play guitar or, you know, hang out at the gym, take a walk, hang out with the kids. And that's the best feeling to me. It's like I'm trying to condense it and see if I can knock things out quicker, save more time. And I live by that list. And it's gotten to the point to where if I try to take a day, like a Sunday, and say, well, I'm not going to do anything, there's no list tomorrow. Literally, man, 2-3 hours into the day, I'm like, I need to do something. Wired for it. And we've talked about this before, too. Like, if it's a to-do list, put the hardest thing on top.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Get the hardest thing over with, because then you have that sense of accomplishment, you know. But the list works for me. I know some people, I know Tony Robbins he's not a big fan of to-do lists, but it works for me. It keeps a lot of things together. And what it does, writing it down, and not just getting the visual of it, but actually visualizing the night before all of those things being finished, it allows me to get further faster. It allows me to accomplish more in less time. And it's interesting because some days I'm crazy, crazy busy, and some days I have more free time than most people. And from the outside looking in, anybody would be like, that guy, he's probably working all day, every day. Well, not necessarily. Some days that list gets knocked out and it's just, you know, do what you want to do, which that's what we're all in it for. I feel, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you're not, I don't know an entrepreneur that cares so much about the exact number as much as they care about the freedom and doing what they want to do. That's the name of the game.
Well, yes, if you're trying to reach any goal in life, you want to better your life, you want to reach for your dreams, whether that is personal, physique. I mean, we all struggle in the 21st century. I mean, you ever look at pictures from 40, 50 years ago, but it was a lot thinner. We're all heavier than we were. And you have to fight back on that and try to control and do more exercise and control what you're eating. I do that. Try. And I have lost weight since about a year ago and have kept it off, and I want to lose more. But it's what you do every day which creates the person that you are. And if you want to learn a new skill, like if you want to advance, like I'm always wanting to, is there any guitar player who's satisfied with the level of guitar playing they're at?
No, none of them. Well, I take that back. There are guitar players that are satisfied with where they're at, but they're the ones that aren't very good that think they are. I mean,
yeah.
All the good ones are miserable. They're like, oh, I should be better than this.
Jeff says it was easier to stay in shape. You mean the Hostess cakes is what you're talking about, Jeff?
Yeah.
I think that's not a temptation for me.
It is me, man. I love that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, yeah, I could enjoy it. I could go hog wild, but I don't let myself get started. But
oh, you do pretty good. You eat pretty clean.
Do I? Thank you.
You do way better than I do.
Well, try. Except I drink a lot of coffee, but I did switch to decaf. So, and water consuming, we all underhydrate. We have to drink more water. But you know, if you want to change something in your life, and if you want to reach a goal, I mean, if you don't have a goal, then that's fine, but you'll probably stay where you are. Like if you want to learn a new skill, like someone wants to learn guitar, doesn't play guitar. I want to learn how to cook, or maybe wants to get a ding dong snowballs and ho hos. I could go on. Snowballs. Wow. Aren't they pink on the inside? Snowballs? I think. I remember those from a kid. Anyway, you have to spend your time. It's so easy. I find it so easy to say, no, I'll do it tomorrow. The gym will be there tomorrow or whatever. But we are what we force ourselves to do every day. And if you're trying to change anything in your life, it takes time and you have to be consistent at it.
And discipline.
Discipline. I mean, if you don't, anyone that, whatever field you admire, I mean, I know Jeff and I are, and you are as well, huge NBA basketball fans. Although you're probably not, I mean, you're more of an NFL fan, I think, Jimmy, but you know, any of those guys that hit those game winning shots, like the Celtics had a game in Denver or Dallas, and, here's James says, goals, adventures, stuff to plan and prepare for. That's what generates energy, both mental and physical energy. Yeah, absolutely, James, 100%.
Yeah, stuff.
You know, so Luka Doncic, probably mispronouncing his name. The Celtics, the game was tied. And the Celtics gave a foul, which they didn't have to, which means that they're going to reset the game clock, which was a fatal mistake. And so that means that the game clock was shut off. And he, with time running out, in fact, the time expired before the ball went through the bucket. And he had three people guarding him because everybody knew Celtics had three people on him guarding him. And he still puts up this three-point shot fading away on one leg. And, of course, it goes in. And the Celtics lose because the game, the time has elapsed by the time before it even gets to the net. Before he released it, it was a good shot. But it takes a few seconds to go from the three-point line to the hoop. It might take three seconds. And, but he released it with plenty of time, and it went through the hoop after time had elapsed. And, of course, the game's over. Now, you don't make a shot like that just saying, yeah, I think I'll do that today. I mean, that's countless hours of drilling. And I don't know how they – I mean, I know that Ray Allen, who I think still has the most three-pointers in her career, that record's going to get broken. Certainly Steph Curry's going to break it. I think Ray Allen still has the most in a career. Maybe he's been eclipsed already, but and other players would try to stimulate. I'd like to know how they stimulate the stress of a game-winning shot. I mean, try to stimulate that. In football, don't they beat on you with kind of foam beaters or yeah. when you're trying to do stuff? What's that?
Batons.
Yeah, batons. Right. To simulate, distraction. And maybe they do that in basketball, but you simulate the stress of taking a game-winning shot with the time on the line. And you just don't, repetition and over and over and over. And so you get to that point on the stage and everybody, if you're a Celtics fan, you're not happy about it, but you're very happy that, you're very happy if you're a fan of that team, that you spend all that time learning that. There, John Mollison. Yes, thank you, John. I think you're speaking of an area much like air combat. Absolutely, I'm sure. Those guys they do drills nonstop all the time. I mean, they do drills. I mean, I don't know much about it. I know that's your field of expertise. You interview all these great, pilots from World War II and now Vietnam, and it's a fascinating thing that you're doing, and it's a great service. Yeah, rote behavior, absolutely. Yeah. Rote behavior. Do you do it so long that you don't even have to think about it? Jeff, thank you for the stats. Ray Allen is still ahead of Steph, I thought, and so Ray Allen is still leading, right? Isn't he, Jeff? I think he's still on top. I'm pretty sure he is. Steph would be the one to catch him, but obviously he's going to catch him if he's only 100 behind. Yeah. He's going to catch him. He's the way he's playing this year. He'll do it this year. Unbelievable. So yeah, it's all about repetition, rote behavior. That's the term, John. Absolutely.
What's the statistic? How many hours to mastery?
Well, what's his name? Like the guy that wrote the 10,000 hours, but there are those who are saying that there's some fallacy to that term, and it really depends on what the Malcolm Gladwell. It really depends on what the task is, but it's all about time, like you have said, on the stool, and it's all about, you want to be a great guitar player. I mean, there is some physical attributes, but there are people that don't have big hands. I mean, you would think you have to have big hands necessarily. There are some great players who don't have really big hands. I mean, look at Tony Iommi. The guy had to put leather things on his tips of his fingers, and Django Reinhardt only had two fingers on his left fretting hand. So physical is not necessarily going to, doesn't mean you can't be a great guitar player. It's all about the practice and the rote learning. Malcolm Gladwell did a study in the book where he talked about 10,000 hours, and that's old book now. It's probably 12, 15 years old now. But he talked about studies. There's a psychology to victory. Absolutely, John, I'm sure. And you probably have heard a lot of this from the pilots that you've been able to rub shoulders with and learn from. Gladwell's too linear, too scientific. Point made. Jeff says, force of habit, powerful. Anyway, one of the things that Gladwell did say is, when you think about classical musicians, what's the difference between a first violinist and, the solo violinist versus the third chair or whatever? And they all go to the same conservatory schools. And they did some research and they found that they could predict who was going to be the first chair and the soloist by how many hours they practiced outside of the curriculum, extra hours that they practiced. And it was very predictive. And again, yeah, very scientific, very linear. I mean, there's that other, that it factor, I guess, that factor you can't really quantify. I get what you're saying, John. I think you're accurate with that.
Yeah, some people just have it.
Yeah. Being able to improvise. Steve Howe and Roy Gallagher could improvise. They had their psychology of victory. Yeah, I mean, that's probably not something you can. Now, classical music is more playing music that's put in front of you. You're not improvising, but improvising is still. But even jazz players, I mean, it's a lot of stringing together little licks or little runs that you have learned. But improvisation is definitely, there's an art to that. I would agree. What do you think, Jimmy?
Absolutely. And, it's same thing. How many hours have you spent improvising? Kind of given into that free thing of, I would imagine it's the same thing with combat pilots of playing guitar. And it's one of my friends, Mike Henderson, that has the Acrobatic Aviation School in California, always equates playing guitar to flying an airplane because there's no reverse. It's like you're thinking of the thing you're getting ready to do instead of what you're actually doing, like a split second ahead of yourself. Crazy. Yeah, Pat Martino just passed. There's a huge loss to the exactly thinking 3D. But one of my buddies, Mike Henderson, and I talk about this thing a lot because it's the same. It really is the same kind of feeling. And I didn't understand what he was saying. And I went and saw him in January and he got me up in his planes and he was doing all these acrobatic maneuvers and he let me fly his plane. I was like, I actually get what you're saying now. It is the exact same feeling. Playing the guitar when it's right and you're not really thinking about what you're playing. It's just kind of happening almost like you're receiving it. And flying an airplane are very much the same thing because your mind is in, it's almost like time travel. Your mind is in the space and time a split second ahead of what you're actually doing. When you're playing the guitar, you're not thinking about the note that you're playing in. You're hearing what you're about to play. When you're flying an airplane, you're not exactly in that moment. You're in the moment that's getting ready to happen in your mind. It's hard to put it into words, but Henderson's been talking about it for years. And I was like, "What? This is insane. What are you talking about?" And I finally felt it. Like when he got me up in that plane, I was like, "Oh, you're right." Because he plays guitar too, It's the same feeling. And I'm not a pilot. I'm not claiming to be, but it is the exact same feeling. But yeah.
Kind of bit you, didn't it, Jimmy? You want to do it again, don't you?
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. It was fun. I want to go up with somebody other than him, though, because he's insane.
How long has Mike been flying? I mean, he must have been playing flying for some time.
Been doing it for a long time. 30 years or better. He's been flying. I can tell you the man has no fear at all. Just from being in there with him, it's like moments that would scare the average human being. When you hear somebody laughing, it's like, oh, this is a different animal. You know what I mean? When I'm about to have a heart attack and he's like, I'm like, yeah, we might not be wired the same.
Fear is a tool of the devil. I think great pilots somehow are able to get rid of that fear. There is a story that my neighbor told me about. I used to go skiing with him. He lived like a few miles from me and we're the only two farmers that I knew of at the time. I was a farmer that would like to go to Denver or to Colorado to go skiing. And there was a local farmer who lived a few miles from both of us, a local neighbor, and he had grown up being a crop duster. His dad was a crop duster, and so they decided to fly with him. I wasn't on this plane, but they flew out to Colorado and flew back. And when they flew back, my friend Tony had his family in there. He had his daughter, or maybe a couple daughters, and son-in-law. And it was a small plane, and apparently the landing gear froze, so it wouldn't distend. I guess it wasn't fixed landing gear, and it must have been retractable landing gear, and it would not distend and or deploy, whatever the correct term would be. And they are trying all these different things. And even tried turning it upside down, you know, spinning, extend. Thank you, John. Spinning upside down to try to, you know, with force to try to get it to break loose, and nothing would happen. And Tony told me the story. His son-in-law was thrown up in the plane, and the vomit, you know, when you're going upside down, was floating in the compartment. It's kind of disgusting. Anyway, couldn't get it to distend. So this was in Huron, South Dakota, is where they landed, and they had all the foam on the runways, and he's flying around the airport to get rid of all of his fuel. It's like, by this time it's like 3 a.m. or something, and he finally puts the plane down on the belly, and they land, and Tony, everybody was pretty shook up except for the pilot. And like the son-in-law that threw up, he swore off. He had a job where he had to fly and travel. He swore off never being in an airplane again. He was so stressed about it. And the pilot was just upset that his prop got nicked, because, you know, it hit the runway, and he was upset that it ruined his prop. And that was about the only emotion that he had. You know, he had, and Tony said he just ice water in his veins. And so I don't know, do you learn that from being a pilot, or is that, you know, do people like that get attracted to being a pilot? I mean, is it learned, or is it pre-selected before you become a pilot?
I think a lot of it's emotional quotient. You know, different people have different degrees of emotional intelligence, and I think people with high emotional quotient can look at something that scares them and just make a decision. I'm not going to be afraid of this.
Couple of great comments here. I'm going to put them up here, Jeff, because of course Jeff spent time in the service in submarines, and that's, you know, I went scuba diving, and I was down like, I don't know, 30-40 feet, and I went through my air fairly soon. I was the first one that went up. I ran out of air, and they said, "Oh, you're scared. You're nervous," because I was breathing hard, I guess. And it was my first time ever. And I was like, man, if this goes under, I'm going to die before I get to the surface. I think we're 40 feet down. So yeah, I mean, imagine being, I don't know how far down you go in a submarine. It's down.
I would be scared to death in a submarine.
And then John says, it's being where you're supposed to be. I would agree with that. I mean, somehow people, even kids, you know, somehow young kids will say, you know, vibrate with something that is their calling, and they're really way young before they could even know it. And yeah, it's being where you're supposed to be. There's something about that. And then John agrees with you, Jimmy. So, we get attracted to the things where we're supposed to be in some way. It's just one of the mysteries of our life. Not always, though. Sometimes people find things later in life, things that are their passions, things that maybe that they should have or could have found earlier. Like you were telling me about your friend. Talk about planes. Let's talk about David.
Yeah. He grew up. His father was kind of like the airplane guru in this part of the country.
Indiana.
And yeah, in Indiana, and David got away from it, but you know, he was.
And what did he try? I mean, just list some of the things he got into.
A little bit of everything. He got into manufacturing, and he got into music, and he got into. He did some construction stuff. He opened a pizza business recently that. Many different business ventures, and he had a brush with cancer. he battled cancer and he fought it and he won. And, you know, he came to the realization that what he loves the most is airplanes, work on airplanes. And he's been in the process of building one for the last 6 months. And now his whole life, like, he sold his pizza business and he doesn't play music anymore. And everything just kind of did 180 for him. And he's sort of back where he started with airplanes.
And how old is he roughly? Is he about your age?
He's a little bit older than me. I think he's 51. But at 51, you know, deciding this is what I really want to do. I think we're going to see more and more of that as opportunities open up. You know, I made a huge transformation 2 years ago at 42 years old. And a lot of people think you're done when you're 40, 42, everything's on autopilot.
For some people, they get there, yeah. Well, some people, basically, it's interesting, the trajectories. And I'd say around 40 is when it starts. Here's a couple of great, we got people making great comments here. Jeff says, likes the feeling of being on our own planet. We cruise at 400 feet. Oh, I would have thought you would have cruised further down than that. Interesting. And train much lower. And John says, yeah, this is a great quote. I love this. The masses of men lived lives of quiet desperation. Yeah. I mean, you have to take it into your own hands and make, but it's hard. I mean, if you want to change your life, we talked about that earlier when we first started, it's usually what you do every day. And it's like people will say that are middle-aged and will say, well, I've always wanted to get this degree or I've always wanted to do that, but it'll take me 10 years to reach that goal or 5 years or whatever it is. And then you just have to look at yourself and say, well, okay, if I don't pursue it, I'll in 5 years or 10 years, where will I be? I'll still be that same age, you know, God allowing that I'm still alive, and I won't have it. So why not pursue it? I mean, my sister got her PhD when she was in her 50s. I don't know how old she was exactly when she graduated, got her. And that's, you know, a little older probably than the typical PhD candidate. You know, go for your stuff. Oh, thank you, John. Appreciate it. Never too old to pursue what you want, as long as you have. I mean, there are people now with you know, there are people that study aging, and there are a lot of people that do. There's different categories. You've got, you know, how long are you? You can still be alive, but you're really not very functioning. You're dependent on healthcare, and maybe you go to the doctor like constantly, and maybe you're not very mobile. But as far as longevity and being able to function and do the things that you want, that has never been as long as it is today. There are people that are taking up new hobbies and doing things in their 80s and even 90s. Not everyone. The life expectancy in the U.S. is still under 80, but that's just the average. And there are a number of people that are still sharp mentally, physically, into their 90s. And why just sit around starting at 40? I mean, that's half of your life. If you live to be in your 80s and 90s and you start the life's over at 40, basically you're giving up halfway through.
Right. Well, the way things felt to me, it was like I just spent the first 40 years collecting data to figure out, you know what I mean? That's how life has felt to me. It was like 40 was almost the magic number of like, okay, I'm not going to say I have a handle on it, but it's like I just kind of woke up at 40.
Well, 100%. I mean, Gary Vee, we're both big fans of Gary Vee, Gary Vaynerchuk. And if you can tolerate the F-bombs, I don't think he can say a sentence without using that. And he says that, and he doesn't apologize for it. He said that's who he is. But he's the most empathetic person, and he advises people on career paths. And he'll have people coming to him and say, you know, I'm in my 20s, and I haven't reached my goals. And he literally laughs at them. He said, you know how much life you have in front of you? Don't even try. And even he constantly posts about if you're 57 or 67 or 73, I mean, you've got a lot of time left, and don't give up. So he hits both sides. The young people that are like 20, and he laughs at them when they say, I should be this far. He said, you spend your entire 20s just experimenting. You got so much more life left. So.
Absolutely.
Gary V is a big inspiration for me almost daily. He puts out so much content, and it's all free. He does it on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I don't know if he's that active on Facebook, but we send each other memes from Gary Vee all the time, don't we? Because he's constantly, he condenses stuff into...
And he's absolutely right. It's why I love the Colonel Sanders story so much. You know, yeah. Colonel Sanders was an old man before he got the KFC thing, before he even really had the idea. And he had decided to commit suicide. And he went and sat under a tree and was writing his goodbye letter. And he gets to thinking, and he was like, is there anything I can do better than anybody else? And he's, I can make the best fried chicken I know. Literally. And he's like, well, if I'm gonna kill myself, then I'm going to try to prove first that I can make the best fried chicken I know. And he'd been through this divorce, this nasty divorce, and lost all his money. And, you know, I mean, long story short, the rest is there's KFC. We saw Kentucky Fried Chicken in Poland and Ukraine. They're all over the world now.
Absolutely. You know? In fact, they were, as far as fast food brands that went international early, KFC was one of the ones that went early. And they have been having international presence in many countries for probably started in the 80s, I would think. So probably 40 years. KFC is one of the first that expanded. And yeah, they're quite well established. In fact, in Japan, I remember in Japan when I was there, it was the thing. Japan's changed. Everything changes. And my image of Japan, very fond memories of Japan, some great memories, some great friends. I was only there for not quite 2 years, but I kept going back because I had business there. I would go back 4 times a year, and I'd spend a month there every November after the harvest, the soybean harvest. Things, I'm sure, have changed there. For example, my friend William posted that he forgot his phone when he got on the train to go to work. And so he was pulled a book that he had purchased from a used bookstore, an antique book. And he was reading it on the train. And he said, everybody was taking pictures of him, the strange guy, Jen, reading a paper book. And I was like, really? Because my image of Japan, I've been there since about 2008, pre smartphones. Everybody had a book. That's what people did on the trains. And they would wrap a plain brown paper over the cover so nobody could see what you're reading. You know, it's all about privacy. So my image of Japan, you get on the train, everybody's reading. Now that's 12-year-old data. I haven't updated my mental picture. Nobody, everybody's got phones now. So they're looking at their phone. Anyway, so this may have changed. But when I lived there, and I'm tying this back, the traditional Christmas dinner, or Christmas Eve at least, was Kentucky Fried Chicken. It was a bird, wasn't turkey, but it was a bird.
Some kind of bad. I'm like,
and it was American, so I guess it was the traditional meal that the younger Japanese would eat anyway. I wonder if that's still the case. I'm not sure, but.
That's hilarious, because almost every single year at Christmas, Katie and I eat Empress of China here in Madison. It's like the only restaurant that's open on Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been the case. Yeah. Well, what movie was it? The Christmas Story.
Yeah.
You're going to shoot your eye out with a BB gun. That one.
Alfie. I love it.
Yeah. So what's your favorite Christmas movie, Jimmy?
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
A Wonderful Life is probably my favorite movie ever, not just Christmas movie. And in fact, I have that's another Christmas tradition, is I watch that movie every year. Yeah. And it still hits me the same exact way as it did the first time I saw it. I'm like, man, this is just, I think it's perfect. Even in black and white, it's still amazing.
John says, don't trust in anyone under 65. I love it. I love it. I guess for younger generations, it's Home Alone. Home Alone is a big you. Love it, John. Wonderful. a big Christmas for my nephews. You know, we watched, in fact, the last Christmas we were all together, we watched Home Alone 1 and 2. Was there a 3? I know there was, I don't think there was a 3. Maybe there was.
I was so late to that whole party that I never even saw those movies until like many, many years after they came out. And the reason why I watched them is because there were so many people that made Home Alone quotes, and I felt like the odd man out.
I know you're feeling. Yeah, because...
And they're like, you haven't seen Home Alone. So I had to watch it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I like It's a Wonderful Life for sure.
That's a great movie.
Phenomenal.
It is, man, because you just don't realize, like, until the chips are down, you don't realize how many people really care about you or how many people you've actually helped. You know, most of us don't even think about that stuff. It's not until things are bad and, you know, then people you didn't even know that you affected them, they come out of nowhere. Yeah.
I don't think that, if I'm remembering now, or I might be confusing the movie with Casablanca. I don't think that was considered anything special when they made Wonderful Life. I know Casablanca wasn't. Casablanca is, and maybe that's too old school for you, but World War II, you're a Casablanca fan?
Sure.
Yeah.
The dog that we just got, the pug that I just got for my wife, is named Bogart.
Awesome.
Humphrey Bogart from that film. Because when I was a little kid, I would always watch old movies with my grandpa. And I loved Casablanca, and I loved Humphrey Bogart in the movie. And I had a puppy when I was a little kid named Bogart because of that character. I always liked
The best years of our lives.
I haven't seen
that one. Who was in it, John? Who were the leading actors in best years of our lives? Well, give me the Wikipedia. Okay. Well, give me the serious thing. I'll have to do it after because I can't. When I click on it, it just puts it on the display. So I'll have to look it up later. Best years of our lives. I'm sure I've seen it, but I'm going to look it up now. Hopefully it doesn't interrupt our thing here. Did I disappear when I did that?
No.
Okay. I'm going to go to another tab here. Well, there's a new Christmas movie that's on Netflix, number one on Netflix. 1946 film, so I'll probably like it. Well, huh. Samuel Goldwyn, it's got to be good. Man, I don't even know any of the actors in it. Myrna Loy and Dana Andrews and Frederick March and Teresa Wright. I mean, no big names that have survived to this day. Readjusting to civilian life after coming home from World War II. That's a great one. I will have to check that out.
Yeah, I want to watch it too.
Yeah. One of the top 100 of all time. Well, thank you. I thank you, John. You're always one to give great suggestions. Thank you. I appreciate it. I will mark that down. Yeah. Coming back from war. I mean, you know, PTSD was not something that we recognized, but, they all, had, you know, if you were in war, even World War II, you know, everybody, the only vaguely, it was never mentioned. Like in my family, people didn't talk about stuff that German, you just bury it, you know, and stuff didn't get talked about. And I remember growing up as a kid, just getting the impression that, okay, this happened, but we can't talk about it because the adults kind of shush or change the subject. You know, even as a kid, you pick up on that. Okay, that's an off subject. I don't know why it's an off subject, but I know it's an off subject.
Yeah, sure. That was my father's approach, you know.
Interesting, John. John says everyone has PTSD. PTS, the D is the problem. John says, I learned this from POWs. Yeah.
Wow.
Huh. That's a good distinction. Thank you for that. Yeah, I know you've spent a lot of time with people who have served in war, and war is hell. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if we could eradicate it, it would be, and it looks like we're going to ramp up again with China. As I just saw an article today, they satellite, they've got mock-ups of our battleships that they're using for target practice in the desert, I guess, or somewhere. It's scary.
You don't want to smoke China.
No. Well, they've got a lot of resources. They've got a lot of people, for sure. And hopefully we'll, you know, if a nuclear war does break out, I want to be right in the center of the target.
Yeah. Make it short and sweet, right?
Yeah, just eviscerate me into fumes.
I don't want to be part of the fallout. I want to be part of the
way. Yeah.
100%.
You know. All right. Well, we've done our 40-minute minimum. Yeah. They have an aging problem. 100%. Yes. And there's some predictions that I'm a big demographics fan. And the huge problem, but they're also talking about the population will decrease. And one prediction that I saw says that their population could decrease, could go from 1.3 billion to 700 million by 2100. And they would be, in fact, Nigeria would be higher in population than China. The continent of Africa is exploding. They're having lots of kids and they're exploding. China has a problem. They definitely have an aging problem. And there's some definitely social economic issues with China and with their totalitarian government trying to keep it together, but those fissures will start to crack. I wouldn't want to be in China. I mean, they're going to be, and I mean, we've had missionaries come to our church, talk about China. They said, China is not a rich country. You think that China has all this money, but they deal with the everyday people and everyone is dealing with, you know, poverty. And the saying is that they say, I think, they're going to get old before they get rich. There always will be those at the top that have money, but the war plan centers around Asian influence in Africa and Southeast Pacific. Yeah. Africa is a major aspect of it. Southwest Pacific. Yeah. Corrected. Yeah. They're building all these man-made islands and staking claims there. I wouldn't want to be in charge of trying to manage our responses to all that in Taiwan, flying all these bombers or fighter jets close to Taiwan. And I wouldn't want to be in charge of trying to tamp down all those fires. What do you think, Jimmy?
I wouldn't want to be that guy either.
Tough job.
That's,
hopefully we have good people doing that. And at least I think based on all the articles, they certainly have woken up. I saw there was a War Games result that was done about a month ago that showed they kicked our butt because of things we were doing that were, I don't know how accurate it was, or maybe it was just released only to wake us up and get people excited. I who knows? There could be lots of other, the Fender Stratacoustic, Jimmy, you can speak on this. I've heard great things about it. Have you played one, Jimmy?
I have not played it. I've read the reviews and seen the articles about it, but I've
reviews
not.
Are good, right? Haven't you?
Yeah, all the reviews I've read and everything I've heard about them is positive, but I haven't gotten my hands on one yet.
John, guitars is always a welcome subject. Much more fun to talk about than Southwest Pacific military buildups.
I love it.
Oh, the Action Blows? Oh, I've not played one, so I don't know. I don't know. That's a good data point. Or maybe that particular one that you had was poorly made. Are they Mexican made? Or, well, actually, the one article that I saw, you know, the made in Mexico fenders have really gotten a lot better in the last 10 years. And one fender guy was quoted as saying, kind of humorously, do you want your fender made by Mexicans in California, or do you want it to be made by Mexicans in Mexico?
Yeah. Oh, fender.
I think it's funny. John's trying to got a bone bridge, trying to fix it up so he has a better action. Good luck with that, John. I hope you can get that straightened out. I mean, I've heard good reviews about it. Very flexible tone machine, from what I've read. It doesn't intrigue me myself, but would you want one, Jimmy?
I've been rationing myself. I've worked really, really hard to not buy any new guitars for the last year and a half. I'm a recovering addict.
Well, I just got a t-shirt for my birthday. My birthday was last weekend, and my sister got me this t-shirt, and I'm going to wear it proudly. It's a, you know, picture of about 10 guitars, and it says, yes, I do need all these guitars. You know, so there is that aspect of being a guitar player. So John was looking for a Kramer Farrington and found that. So
nice.
All right, well, shall we call it? Thank you for hanging with us. And if you're watching this on the replay, thank you.
Commenting.
Yeah, appreciate the dialogue.
Absolutely. Till next time.
You bet. See ya.